Okay, so here's what I want to do today. I want to start by talking about the final exam, answering any questions you have, make sure we're all comfortable with what the process is going to be. Then after that, talk a little bit about enforcing U.S. judgments abroad, specifically kind of focus on enforcing U.S. judgments in the EU and in Canada. I've got some hypotheticals. I'd like to be able to work through those. And then quit a little bit early and do the course evaluation. So that's my plan. Please don't let me go astray on that. All right, so let me start by the exam. The exam, as you know, is going to be a take-home exam. It will be available from the TWIN page starting on this Saturday by noon. Okay, and so you can, and I'll send an email via TWIN to you all to let you know that it's available. You can download the exam from there. My expectation is that you will complete the exam and return it by the last day of finals, which is Saturday, May 12th, let's say by 5 p.m. Okay, and return it via the assignment drop box on TWIN. I'll set up an assignment and you can return it there. Please use, the instructions will prompt you, but make sure that you use your exam number rather than your name or any other number that might personally identify you. If for some reason you cannot get the assignment uploaded on TWIN, then please send an email to my assistant, Debbie Scott, attaching your answer as a separate attachment. And then Debbie will print it out, preserve your anonymity, and give it to me that way. Okay, so that's the process. Any questions about the process? Got it? And I'll put, yeah.
May 12th.
May 12th. May 12th at 5 p.m., which is the last day of final exams, including the makeup days. Okay. All right, so that's the process by which we're going to do this. Available on TWIN, return it to TWIN. I think I've said this before. I'm giving you a long time to complete this, but in no way is it my expectation that it would take a student the entire exam period to complete the exam. I'm giving you a long time to complete it so you can best fit it in with your other exam obligations and end-of-the-year obligations. The exam will be three essay questions. You're permitted to use your notes, use the course materials, anything we worked with in class, but please do not, and you should not need to, conduct any independent legal or factual research to answer the exam questions. And also, you're taking the exam under the honor code, so please work independently. Do not work collaboratively with anyone in the class or any attorneys you may know or, you know, anyone else you think might give you a really good answer, okay? Now, once the exam comes out, I can't answer specific questions. So if you have questions, please get your questions to me by Saturday, by email. I'll be around all week, so you can stop by the office and talk to me that way as well. If you really want to talk to me in person and you're having a hard time finding me, email me and we'll set up an appointment so that you can make sure to get your questions answered. Any other questions? Anything that we talked about in class, any of the assigned readings, any of that will be fair game. I won't test you on things outside of what we discussed in the class, though. All right. If you have questions during the exam period about the exam administration, like you can't figure out the instructions or you can't get the exam, you can ask me those questions. I just want to answer any specific questions about the course content. Anything else? Oh, that was painless. Okay. All right. So I want to just talk a little bit to conclude our class about the recognition and enforcement of U.S. judgments abroad. You know from reading the casebook, we talked about service. We talked a little bit about the Hague Convention on Private International Law, and the Hague Convention was very successful in negotiating a pretty extensive international treaty on service of process and discovery issues. People in the Hague Convention attempted to negotiate a universal treaty on recognition and enforcement of judgments, but thus far have not really been able to do that successfully. So, and there's been a couple of barriers. If you've read, you know, part of the barrier has been some differences in the difference between different ways in which the member countries exercise jurisdiction. I made reference to this before. Always one big sticking point is the idea that the U.S. exercises rather broad and somewhat amorphous jurisdiction over out of U.S. foreign defendants. The concept of minimum contacts is fairly uncertain as opposed to some of the continental traditions in defining jurisdiction. That's a barrier. Tag jurisdiction, it turns out, is kind of a hang-up, too. Now, the U.K. and the United States recognize the idea that if you're served with process while in the jurisdiction, even if temporarily, you're subject to jurisdiction, but not all jurisdictions do recognize that, and so that's always been a little bit of a hang-up. Also, some of the kind of unique features of the U.S. legal system, the idea of pretrial discovery being pretty extensive here, the availability of punitive damages and class actions tend to be barriers to negotiating any kind of comprehensive recognition of judgments abroad. So anyway, what you end up with is essentially some regional agreements. I gave you the EU one as a good example of a regional agreement on the recognition and enforcement of judgments, and then everything else kind of left to the national law of the enforcing state. So that's what I want to take a look at. The other thing is the EU treaty is a nice treaty to look at because it's a bilateral treaty. Anybody know what that means? As opposed to a unilateral treaty?
No.
So bilateral could mean two parties. It actually means, and also means in the context of this, it's a treaty that negotiates both jurisdiction and judgment and ties the two together, which was kind of a unique feature when the EU negotiated it. So you know, if you read through the excerpt you have on the EU treaty, or if you actually pulled up the link to the EU treaty itself and the Brussels regulation, as I said, it's divided into two main parts. It regulates jurisdiction as well as recognition and enforcement of judgments. It starts with jurisdiction. On the jurisdiction side, it creates two different classes. It creates jurisdictional rules for essentially EU defendants, cases in which the defendant is a national or domiciled in a member state, creates one set of jurisdictional rules for those parties, and then has a second classification, treats those defendants who are not EU nationals differently. So with respect to parties that are domiciled or are nationals of a member state, a European, an EU national, the treaty basically sets out the exhaustive bases for jurisdiction. A court of a member state can only exercise jurisdiction over a defendant who is a national or a domicile of a member state pursuant to the bases in the treaty. And the treaty has basically a provision that allows for general jurisdiction. So a EU defendant can always be sued in his or her country of domicile or residence. And then it provides a few categories of specific jurisdiction based on the type of action and some specific context. So by way of example, in a contract action, an EU member court can exercise jurisdiction over the defendant if the EU state was the place of performance. In a tort case, the place where the harmful act occurred can exercise jurisdiction. Those are the only bases for jurisdiction, only the bases recognized in the treaties. That's the only way that a member state can exercise jurisdiction, cannot exercise jurisdiction on any other basis, even those that comport with national law. And in fact, in negotiating the treaty, the member states carved out a few practices that the one member state found particularly offensive with respect to another member state. So the treaty expressly says, cannot exercise jurisdiction on the basis of tag jurisdiction. I'm just saying, tag jurisdiction commonly recognized and as the appropriate basis in the UK. The continental jurisdictions did not recognize the idea of tag jurisdiction, so that under the treaty expressly provides that UK courts cannot exercise tag jurisdiction over an EU defendant. We talked before about the French nationality provision that allows French courts to exercise jurisdiction over a defendant because the plaintiff is a French citizen. Treaty excludes that, so that the French courts cannot exercise jurisdiction over an EU national just because the plaintiff is a French national. Instead, is limited by the treaty. German courts recognize a form of quasi in rem jurisdiction. Everybody remember quasi in rem jurisdiction back from your jurisdictional days, which is particularly onerous. And so under the treaty, courts in Germany cannot exercise quasi in rem jurisdiction over the property of a EU national defendant. Even though these things would be perfectly fine bases under the national law of the respective countries. And so just to give you, we didn't talk about this German provision in particular, but just to give you a little insight, remember that old case of Harris versus Bach? Anybody remember that case? I love to teach it, but I don't think anybody else teaches it because it's nothing other than I find it humorous. But so the German courts can exercise jurisdiction over any property located of the defendant located within the jurisdiction of the court, located within Germany. And property includes everything, real property as well as personal property, tangible as well as intangible property. So think about intangible property, what's some of the intangible property that people and institutions commonly hold. I always ask students, think about, for instance, your bank account. Your bank account, obviously, we all recognize as a form of property, right? Think about what your bank account really is. Basically, when you have a bank account, a simple savings account or something, you're a creditor of the bank, right? We all know, we all recognize, I hope, right, that when you put your $200 in your savings account, the bank does not put it in a lockbox, hold it for you, and then someday you come and you get your $200 back, right? Instead, the bank takes your $200, pools it with a whole lot of other money, and invests it in various ways, and then when you come looking for your $200 plus the 1% interest or whatever you've got, the bank just pays you out of some other money. So that essentially your property is really the debt, right? The debt that the bank owes you to pay the $200 plus interest. Okay, that's a form of property. Under this German conception of jurisdiction, you own property in Germany if the bank has an office in Germany. And by the way, Harris versus Bach was a case where the US Supreme Court said that was true. Right? Property, the debt attaches to the debtor, anywhere the debtor is located, the defendant is located. So that's a pretty expansive read of jurisdiction. That's one of the things that the EU member states negotiated out. German courts can't exercise that kind of quasi-in-rem jurisdiction over EU nationals. Okay, so on that side, that's what we do with members, defendants who are EU nationals. For everybody else, the jurisdictional law of the court, the national law of the court, actually applies. So, for instance, in the UK, if the defendant is a EU national, is a German citizen, is a French citizen, is a Dutch citizen, the UK court cannot exercise tag jurisdiction over the defendant. If, on the other hand, the defendant is a US citizen, the UK court can exercise tag jurisdiction over the defendant. In France, right, the French courts cannot exercise this nationality jurisdiction over defendants who happen to be domiciled or are nationals of the UK, of Germany, of Italy, but can exercise it over US citizens. Quasi in rem jurisdiction we were just talking about. Even though the German courts cannot exercise quasi in rem jurisdiction over the property of EU nationals, can over US nationals. So that's one side of the treaty. Side is the recognition and enforcement side, and one of the innovations that the drafters of this treaty came up with is the idea that recognition and enforcement is tied to jurisdiction. So it starts with a general principle of enforceability, recognition and enforceability. Any judgment issued by a court of a member state is presumed to be enforceable in the courts of all the other member states. That's the presumption. As long as the rendering court exercised jurisdiction consistent with the treaty, the judgment's enforceable. And the enforcing court cannot re-examine jurisdiction. The rendering court has an obligation under the treaty to enforce jurisdictional rules, to recognize jurisdiction only consistent with the treaty. Once it does, presumed enforceable in all the courts of any member states, and we cannot re-examine the jurisdictional ruling. There's a few exceptions put in that look a little bit like that Uniform Money Judgment Act here in the United States, and that is there's an exception for public policy. There's an exception if the judgment is an insufficient, is a default judgment and the defendant had insufficient time to actually prepare a defense. If the judgment that the parties are seeking to enforce is inconsistent with a previous judgment by another member state, then it doesn't have to be enforced. There's also an exception which, if the judgment is in a civil matter or a commercial matter and the court goes beyond what is necessary to resolve the commercial dispute between the parties and somehow touches on the marital relationship, the status of the parties, or the legal obligations imposed by their marital relationship, then that also doesn't have to be enforced. So any resolution in a commercial dispute that affects, like community property, would be potentially unenforced, not necessarily need to be enforced under this provision. Okay. This applies to all judgments rendered by a member state court, regardless of whether the defendant is a national, an EU national, or not. As long as the jurisdiction is pursuant to the treaty, which, remember, for non-EU defendants means as long as it's consistent with the national law of the rendering state, the enforcing state has to enforce the judgment. For those judgments, obviously, that come from courts of non-member states, U.S. judgments, then the treaty relegates those to national law. So a judgment from a U.S. court is enforceable in U.K. pursuant to whatever the U.K. common law is dealing with the recognition and enforcement of judgments. Is enforceable in Germany pursuant to the German Civil Code with respect to recognition and enforcement of judgments. Yeah.
Is there an independent policy reason for the last one, or is it just the different states have different
I'm sure there is.
Sex marriage?
I think, well, this was in there before the prevalence of debate about same-sex marriage, so I don't think this is really pertaining to that. I think it really has to do with, even before that, different conceptions of marital property, community property, versus, I don't know, what marital property versus community property, is that how we articulate those differences? Like civil versus, because that's a big divide between the civil tradition and the common law tradition, is the way that we acquire and distribute property acquired during a marriage. And I would gather, although I don't know, now I'm like really speaking beyond my realm of competence here. Remember, you've still got like a divide between religious traditions, including some continental nations that are heavily Catholic and some that are Protestant. And so I think maybe differences even about divorce, like as basic as that, might still be animating this, but I don't think it's pertaining specifically to same-sex unions. Any other questions? Okay. All right. So that's the basic international thing. And I said this really was an innovation because this is one of the first comprehensive treaties negotiated on a regional level that also takes this bilateral approach and ties jurisdiction and recognition of enforcement of judgments together so nicely and compactly. You've also got some national approaches. I put on reserve and I had on the syllabus a little reading about the German national approach to enforcing judgments. I gave you a case from the Canadian Supreme Court, which I think kind of looks at two different ways that national law might approach this. So the German conception still starts with a presumption of enforceability, but gives you some basic kind of guidelines. In order for the foreign judgment to be enforceable in Germany, it has to be final. And final under the conception of German law, as opposed to American law. So in a judgment that's final at the district court level, but on appeal, we would consider to be final. Right? A judgment is enforceable once the district court enters judgment. But for German courts, even though we would consider it to be final, the German courts will not enforce that. They don't consider that to be a final judgment. It has to be through all the levels of appeal. German judgment has to, the rendering court has to have had jurisdiction under the German conception of jurisdiction. Again, German jurisdiction is pretty expansive for U.S. judgments, not as big of a problem. Still recognizing quasi and rem jurisdiction. Probably the biggest problem for barrier to the recognition and enforcement of U.S. judgments in German courts is this idea of public policy. The foreign judgment cannot be repugnant to the public policy of Germany, and in particular, has to rise to almost a constitutional level of unfairness. But of particular concern for German courts are things like the availability of a contingency fee, the inability to recoup your costs if you prevail, the American non-fee-shifting rule, the availability of pretrial discovery. Punitive damages are also a big barrier to the enforcement of judgments in Germany. German courts have a pretty sharp divide between the civil law and the criminal law, and punitive damages look too much like the criminal law under the German tradition to allow for enforceability. And then German courts also have this concept of, or the German code has this concept of reciprocity. German courts will only enforce a judgment if the courts of the rendering state would enforce a similar German judgment. Contrast that with the Canadian case I gave you, and that's probably a more expansive approach to the recognition and enforcement of judgments. It allows for essentially the recognition and enforcement of foreign judgments whenever the Canadian courts think that the rendering court would have jurisdiction under Canadian notions of what jurisdiction is, and pretty broad notions at that. So let's take a look at a couple of hypotheticals I gave you. Forgot. Anybody have an extra copy floating around back there? Forgot to save one for myself. Yeah. Okay, so take a look at the first one. And let's just start by, would an American judgment be enforceable in Germany? So what do you think? How many people think that this judgment will be enforceable in Germany? How many people think not? Why not? Just a guess?
It doesn't look like they have product liability.
Okay. Yeah, okay. So let's walk through the analysis and let's see if we can figure out where the tipping point is. So first of all, hopefully everybody recognizes, even though Germany is an EU member state, we're dealing with a judgment from the US, so essentially the treaty here doesn't apply, because the treaty only applies to judgments rendered by one member state, the courts of a member state. That's not our situation here. Then we're just relegated to national law, whatever German civil code says about the recognition and enforcement of judgments. And I said that Germany starts with the presumption that the judgment is enforceable as long as the rendering court has jurisdiction over the defendant pursuant to conceptions of jurisdiction under German law. Probably satisfied here based on our limited knowledge about German jurisdiction, but also has an idea of there has to be some reciprocity. Do you think if the tables were turned, if a German court issued a judgment against an American manufacturer under similar circumstances, an American court would enforce that judgment? What do you think? You know a little bit about the enforcement of foreign judgments in U.S. courts. Would a U.S. court enforce a products liability judgment against an American manufacturer who sold products in Germany through a German distributor? Think, Adam? Yeah, what do you think? Again, remember that Uniform Recognition and Enforcement of Money Judgments Act starts with a presumption of enforceability, has some mandatory and some permissive exceptions. One of the big mandatory exceptions is when the rendering court lacked personal jurisdiction, jurisdiction as measured by U.S. standards. So the question would be whether or not really the U.S. courts would think that there would be jurisdiction over the American manufacturer in Germany. That's kind of a Nicastro question, where we left off the other day. It's unavoidable, can't avoid this case, right? But assuming that the American manufacturer has done something to direct its commercial activity at Germany beyond just putting a product in the stream of commerce, even post-Nicastro, that's enough to say there's personal jurisdiction. So we'd want to know a little bit more about the relationship between the American manufacturer and the distributor, and we'd want to know what else the American manufacturer is doing, if anything, that's directed towards the German market, to really be able to answer that question. Assuming that the American manufacturer is purposely availing itself of the German market under American notions of that, then it looks like the judgment would be enforceable. If a German judgment's enforceable here, then the American judgment should be enforceable there, except it also cannot be repugnant to German public policy. And so, you guys all seem to want to say, here, where it looks like there's absolutely no such thing as a products liability claim, to grant a judgment or enforce the judgment would be repugnant to German public policy. I think that's what everybody seemed to think this was not enforceable. Let's unpack this a little bit. What if there is a claim? It's just that the consumer cannot hold the manufacturer liable unless they're in privity with one another. You have to buy directly from the manufacturer in order to have a claim in products liability. Is this American judgment, which recognizes a claim even though the product's bought through the distributor, through some channel of distribution, is that repugnant to German public policy, you think? How many people think yes, still is? How many people think nope, if that's the only difference, not really? So can you come up with some arguments, some compelling arguments, why it is or isn't repugnant to public policy?
Maybe on the is side, just that it moves it into an entirely new body of law, like out of contract into tort, once the conditions change, they have to be in privity.
And why might that be significant, moving it like that?
It's how they distribute the risk.
Yeah, I think that might be a good reason, right? If we have reason to think that the German manufacturer not expecting liability based on distribution through the channels of distribution hasn't properly made some accommodation for the risk, either in pricing the product or in purchasing insurance, then that might be a reason why this is repugnant to public policy. Anybody not? There were some people not. Yeah?
I think realistically, it pretty much absolves German manufacturers from any sort of liability once they ship their products out of the country, because it's hard to believe there's going to be privity, direct privity at least.
Yeah, these days it seems unlikely, which is kind of a bad thing. But why, if you're the German court, why not absolve German manufacturers of risk? I'm assuming, right? You're a German judge sitting in Germany. That might be a good thing.
You might eventually start to leave business.
Yeah.
Yeah. They make good stuff.
What about the fact that there is liability? It's just how big the scope of liability is, such that the manufacturer's aware of some potential for liability and has to prepare for some liability. It's just how far down the chain we expand that liability. I don't know, maybe. Okay, what about if instead can bring a claim against the manufacturer, even if you're not in privity, but can't be held liable for pain and suffering under German law, which, by the way, I think is actually closer to the true state of German law. What do you think? Is a judgment that includes damages for pain and suffering repugnant to German public policy if Germany does not recognize damages for pain and suffering? How many people think repugnant to public policy? How many people think not? Anybody got another solution, possibly? Actually, this is one where I'm not being facetious. I think there is another option here. So let's put some specific numbers in. Let's say the judgment is a judgment where the plaintiffs recover $200,000 for future medical expenses, $25,000 for past medical expenses, $10,000 for future diminished earning capacity, because it's hard to type when you don't have one of your fingers working properly or something like that. And $300,000 for pain and suffering, and another $175,000 for punitive damages. Sound good? Everybody okay with those? All right. So, should the German court enforce the judgment, and if so, to what extent, if German law doesn't recognize a claim for non-economic losses? What do you think, Ed?
There's a principle of substantive approach that says that you can strike what's repugnant to the German code, and then you can just maintain what is viable there.
So it may be that you think that the non-economic losses are repugnant, but the court can enforce that portion of the verdict which goes towards the medical expenses, maybe the diminished earning capacity, just not the non-economic losses. By the way, this is a pretty good front-end litigation planning lesson. So let's say that you are representing the U.S. parents here in the action against the German manufacturer in the North Carolina state courts. One thing, hopefully, you quickly perceive is that you may need to enforce this judgment in Germany, right? There may not be enough assets here in the United States. You may need to go over to Germany. If you know that, and you know, as Adam said, that the German courts will not enforce a judgment if it's repugnant to to German public policy, and you have reason to suspect that some portions of this verdict might be, what do you want to make sure that you ask the judge to get from the jury?
The damage actually suffered. Not the pain and suffering, but the diminished capacity, all the other stuff.
You want to make sure that you get a verdict with special interrogatories that forces the jury to break down its words. So maybe you don't know, but the presumption would be in most states that the jury would just render a general verdict. Plaintiff recovers $1 million. That's not too helpful for you, right? Because if you go over to Germany and all you've got is a verdict that's $1 million, and the records of the proceedings show that you put on evidence and argued to recover pain and suffering losses and punitive damages in addition to economic losses, that will be a difficult verdict, judgment, to defend in Germany. If you get a verdict with answers to special interrogatories where you get the jury to give you an itemized verdict like that, that might be more enforceable. Because if at least you can enforce some of it, right? So on the front end, you might want to be aware of that. And by the way, why might anybody think it still, even the pain and suffering portion, can you think of any reasons why that still might be recoverable? Or some things you might want to know about to help make a better argument that the whole verdict should be recoverable. Yeah.
Would seeking therapy or things like that be?
You know, that generally would be covered by the future medical expenses. I mean, if you can really show that this person will need therapy directly related to the injury, then that would come in under the future medical expenses. To the extent that you can't, though, I mean, that's a hard thing to prove. Think about what we're talking about. Proving that a child whose finger has been seriously injured and deformed at a young age is going to need therapy at some point in her life. To deal with the emotional aspects of that, you have to show that's reasonably certain. That's turns out kind of hard to prove, given the nature. I mean, some things, it's obvious, but your finger, that's hard to prove. But the pain and suffering component will be for like the inherent mental anguish and the physical pain that you recover. And so you might argue, you know, given that you can't establish those future damages on the economic side with any certainty, this pain and suffering is really about future economic losses. It's about those future therapy expenses. That might be a way to try to do this. Let me point out one other thing which I made reference to. So let's assume that the plaintiff's lawyer here is working on a contingency fee. And so the plaintiff's lawyer will recover 30% of the judgment that's ultimately recovered. Does that make the judgment more enforceable in Germany or less enforceable, you think? So let me also give you a little background. Germany, like many civil law countries, like many countries, period, does not recognize the concept of a contingency fee. In fact, I think it would be unethical. It would violate German ethical regulation of lawyers to enter into a contingency fee arrangement in Germany. So does that, you think, make this a better case that this verdict is repugnant to public policy, or a better case that the court ought to allow the recovery? So we probably need to think a little bit, fill in the blanks about what we can make some assumptions about the economics of the legal profession in Germany. You can't work on a contingency fee, so how do you think German lawyers get paid?
Much more steep up front.
Well, that would be nice, although, you know, the likelihood that an injured party has the money up front is pretty slim. So any other ideas?
This would be kind of crazy, but take some sort of interest in property or something like that?
Can't do that. Can't do that here either. But
it's a wild guess.
But good. Legal costs can be tacked on as one of the damages that the plaintiff suffers. So I guess it is kind of paying up front, except you don't really pay up front. The legal costs get tacked on. So you don't get a 30% cut of the verdict, but part of the verdict is an itemized, here's what the damages were in terms of, that the plaintiff suffered in terms of having to pay the lawyer to bring that case. Okay, so I tell you that little bit of information. Does this make this judgment, including a part of the verdict for non-economic losses, do you think this makes it more likely to violate public policy or less likely? I think you could argue this both ways. In what sense does it make this judgment more repugnant to German public policy? Yeah. So now, not only are you recovering damages that German law doesn't recognize, the lawyer's operating under a financing scheme that we don't that German courts don't recognize. You know, this has got to go beyond just pointing out differences, though. Why does it matter? I mean, why is it a bad thing? Can you think of any reasons why jurisdictions would not recognize contingency fees? What is the inherent risk of them? Yeah.
Maybe just to ensure equal access to attorneys and stuff like that, because it's a contingency fee. Attorneys are probably more prone to kind of shop their own cases to make it worth their while.
Okay. Any other ideas? Yeah.
Maybe if you're working at contingency and you don't think the claim is worth very much, you might not take it. So then
I think that dovetails with Patrick's point about equal access to judgment or to justice, right? Yeah.
Ask for more damages.
It might cause you to inflate the damage award, for sure. Think about the incentives. I mean, this is always a tricky thing. If you're a plaintiff's lawyer, it's a tricky ethical position to find yourself in. So if you are working on a contingency fee, think about what your incentives are from your own perspective. I mean, this is serious. There is an ethical resolution to this. I am in no way suggesting that plaintiff's lawyers are unethical. I'm suggesting, though, that this is one of the difficulties you encounter as a plaintiff's lawyer. So your incentive, right, you get a third of the recovery. So obviously you have great incentive to maximize recovery. You also are paying the costs up front. So you have great incentive to minimize the costs, maximize the recovery, which may or may not align necessarily with the same incentives that your client has with respect to settlement. And so part of it's a concern about that potential, right, for the idea. People looking. So your client may want to go for broke, go push it all the way to the verdict to get the maximum extent possible. You might be willing to settle for a little bit less early on to minimize the costs. Your client may have other reasons for wanting to go to judgment, may also just be blind to that, right? So that potential for kind of abuse of the lawyer-client relationship might be a reason why. Okay, back to our question about public policy. Is this, you think, consistent with German public policy, or what would be an argument that this is still, or perhaps even a better case for enforcing the judgment once we know there's pain and suffering damages, there's also a contingency in there? Yeah.
Well, if you only award the itemized out-of-pocket expense damages, then that's a third that's going to go to the attorneys that you know of, so then that's the money that they have to spend on.
In fact, there's some published translations of German decisions that actually do enforce the non-economic losses for that reason, because they kind of take a holistic approach and say, hey, at the end of the day, had this been a German judgment, it's true you wouldn't have the non-economic losses in there, but you would have the legal costs taxed on. On the other hand, you don't have the legal costs here. Some of that non-economic loss is really compensating the plaintiff for those attorney's fees as opposed to, like, true pain and suffering. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, courts have enforced that. You know, I put in this little bit about the administrative compensation through an administrative proceeding to make this point about the holistic idea, too. How many people think that ultimately, if the German courts have this administrative proceeding, allow for compensation for injury through an administrative proceeding, that makes it easier or more difficult? What do you think? Is it easier or more difficult to enforce the U.S. judgment? Yeah.
It would make it much more difficult.
Why do you think much more difficult?
Because there's no power of a treaty. I mean, there's no. It's just exclusively just German administrative law.
Mm-hmm. This goes back to the point that it's a claim that the German courts don't even recognize. They've got a whole different system to deal with this, and so the manufacturer doesn't have any expectation of liability. To the extent that the manufacturer does have expectation of liability, it's insuring or covering itself through this administrative system. On the other hand, I still think you can make an argument. Again, the German court talks about looking at repugnant to public policy as a holistic approach. You have to look at the entire scope of German law and the outcome of this specific case versus what the outcome would be as a result of this transaction happening in Germany. And you can make the case that even though the German courts don't recognize this, if this had happened in Germany, there would be compensation. It would just be through the administrative proceeding. So that it is not as if this is a wrong or an injury that Germany doesn't recognize. It just has a different way to compensate it. And so that might actually be an argument in favor of enforcing this thing. Okay, so let's take a look also, what's the next part of this? What if you get the U.S. judgment, and now you want to go to Canada and enforce it against the Canadian assets of the German manufacturer?
Is
All right, so how many people think the U.S. judgment is enforceable against the German manufacturer in Canada? Everybody thinks it's not enforceable? So let's start with a framework to guide us. Under what circumstances will a Canadian court enforce a foreign judgment? Yeah?
If the foreign court would enforce the Canadian judgment?
So that you got to work your way through that Canadian Supreme Court decision and figure out what's going on. One thing the court talks about is reciprocity. Maybe do this through the historical progression. Prior to this Canadian Supreme Court decision that you have, under what circumstances, historically, at common law, would Canadian courts enforce a foreign judgment? Yeah.
Is that the quotation on page 14, where the defendant is a subject of the foreign country in which the judgment is obtained, where he was a resident in the foreign country when the action began, where the defendant in the character of plaintiff has selected the forum in which he is afterwards sued, where he has voluntarily appeared, and where he has contracted to submit himself.
Okay, so take a look at that block quote on page 14. That actually comes from an English case. And so the Canadian Supreme Court here is telling you that historically, Canadian law with respect to the recognition and enforcement of foreign judgments has basically been just to mirror the old English common law rule. And the English common law was pretty restrictive. First of all, it's a matter of comity in private international law. But beyond that, the English courts would only enforce a foreign judgment if you could meet one of these five things. And they're narrow. Think about it. In order to enforce the judgment, you have to be able to say that the defendant was actually a subject of the rendering court, a subject of the country in which the rendering court is, right? Or was a resident of the country where the rendering court was when the action began, not when the principal events took place, but when the lawsuit began, or this next one, which is oddly worded, but think about what it means, where the defendant in the character of the plaintiff has selected the forum in which he is afterwards sued. Can anybody put that in simple English? When does that apply? When is a defendant in the character of a plaintiff? You know, it's just odd wording.
When the original defendant's counterclaim.
When the judgment's from a counterclaim. The judgment's a counterclaim. The defendant on the counterclaim is the plaintiff who selected the forum. Okay. So the judgment on a counterclaim, where he voluntarily appeared, or where he has contracted to submit himself to the forum, where there's a contractual clause consenting to jurisdiction in the forum. And those are the only five circumstances. Okay, that's the historical idea, which, by the way, if that's really the law in Canada, is this judgment enforceable against the German manufacturer? Well, is the German manufacturer a subject of North Carolina or the United States? I'm just making up North Carolina, by the way. I didn't put it on the sheet, so I feel like you're not. No, not a U.S. citizen. Was the defendant a resident in the foreign country when in the U.S. when the lawsuit began? Probably not in any way we can think of resident, even for corporations. The defendant is not. The verdict's not on a counterclaim here. We might want to know whether or not the manufacturer appeared. If the manufacturer actually voluntarily appeared in the lawsuit and litigated the lawsuit, then maybe we can enforce it on that grounds. Where he's contracted to submit himself to the forum in which the judgment was obtained, given that we're dealing with a tort of products liability action, that probably isn't really something that's taken place here. Okay, so limited grounds. But, you know, the Canadian Supreme Court is actually expanding the law in this case. And it starts by talking about the fact that before this decision even gets to the Canadian Supreme Court, lower courts have started to expand the judgment on this basis of reciprocity. There's no reason not to enforce the foreign judgment if a foreign court would actually enforce a Canadian judgment. But I think if you look carefully, the court's actually going further than that. Ultimately, why is it that the Canadian Supreme Court says that this judgment's enforceable. By the way, this is not a foreign case. Everybody pick up on this? This is kind of, it's actually, so where are the two, where's the, where was the rendering jurisdiction in the actual case, and where's the enforcing jurisdiction? So this really comes closer to an intrastate, right? This is really more like Colorado and Nebraska fighting than it is really about a foreign judgment. Under what circumstances must a province recognize the judgment of a sister province, according to the Canadian Supreme Court here?
When there's substantial contact.
That substantial contact's important, and why is it? What is that concept that the court's linking up there? You got it.
Like to the nationality, so everyone is Canadian. I mean, they connected it to the full faith and credit clause.
So the Canadian court here creates, although it doesn't want to use the words full faith and credit, it creates something that looks a lot like full faith and credit for the provinces in Canada, such that one province has to recognize the judgment of another province when the rendering province had a real and substantial connection to the defendant or the dispute. That really skips a link. What the court's really doing here is tying recognition and enforcement of judgment to jurisdiction. That real and substantial connection is the court's articulation of under what circumstances the rendering court has jurisdiction over the defendant. And if the rendering court has jurisdiction over the defendant, then it's enforceable in any of the sister provinces. It's got some reasons tied specifically to Canada for wanting to do that. It talks about the whole idea of creating the Federation of Provinces in Canada is much like the United States, to promote a more integrated nationwide economy, marketplace. And one of the things you have to do in order to make that happen is to allow for recognition and enforcement of judgments to help provide for more predictability in commercial transactions. Turns out, if you think about that, though, that reasoning can go beyond just the provinces in Canada, and lower Canadian courts have extended this judgment and said it applies to U.S. judgments as well, with some exceptions. Can't be a penal judgment, so you can't enforce a tax liability in Canada, a U.S. tax liability in Canada, or a U.S. environmental liability. That's always kind of a big problem. But for the most part, like general commercial civil judgments are enforceable as long as the U.S. court had jurisdiction under the Canadian notions of personal jurisdiction, which you're right, the court talks about a real and substantial connection. Okay, now back to our case. Did the U.S. court have personal jurisdiction over the German manufacturer under that Canadian idea of real and substantial connection? So take a guess, 50-50, no recourse here if you're wrong. How many people think that the Canadian court would find that the U.S. court has personal jurisdiction over the German manufacturer? Anyone? How many people think not? So those in the not camp, why would you argue not?
Because it seems that all this, the only connection between Canada and the action is the availability of.
Now remember, we're talking about two different things. The rendering court has to have personal jurisdiction. That means the U.S. court's the rendering court. That means the U.S. court has to have personal jurisdiction. But when we decide whether or not the U.S. court has personal jurisdiction, we will apply Canadian law. So it's not that the German manufacturer has to be subject to personal jurisdiction in Canada. It's that the German manufacturer has to be subject to jurisdiction in North Carolina, Ohio, name your U.S. jurisdiction, but under that test that the Canadian courts would articulate. So let me try this with them. This is not true. But let's say Canadian courts say that there can never be personal jurisdiction over the defendant unless the defendant is served while present in the jurisdiction. And for an institutional entity like a corporation, that means the corporation has to have its principal place of business in the jurisdiction. Let's pretend for a moment that's Canadian law. Is this, if that's the standard, is this judgment enforceable? No. Why not? Right. In order for the U.S. to have jurisdiction under Canadian law, we have to be able to say that the German manufacturer had its principal place of business in the U.S. state where the judgment was rendered. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about looking at the U.S. contacts, but measuring them under the Canadian standard. Okay, that is not the state of Canadian law. The court tells you it's actually moved past that. That was at one point. But the court's evolved there and said no, as long in a previous Canadian Supreme Court decision, the Canadian Supreme Court has said that the court has jurisdiction, the provincial court has jurisdiction, as long as the defendant has a real and substantial connection with the province. So in our case, the judgment is enforceable if we can say that the U.S. state has a real and substantial connection with the German manufacturer under that Canadian standard. Now let me try again. How many people think that the judgment's enforceable? How many people think not? Okay. Why do you think that the judgment's enforceable? Why is there jurisdiction? Or just articulate for me what the real and substantial connection is. Yeah. Note that that case that the Canadian Supreme Court cites is a stream of commerce case. Granted, provincial. But it involves a Canadian manufacturer who manufactures a product in one province, places it into the stream of commerce with the expectation, or at least reasonably should know, should be foreseeable that its product will be sold in the province where it ultimately is. And the court says that confers jurisdiction on the province where the plaintiff is injured. By the way, would you say that that is more expansive or less expansive than U.S. concepts of personal jurisdiction today? In the U.S., if a manufacturer in Maryland, I mean, let's say, this is kind of artificial, but let's pretend you have a manufacturer that really does nothing but sit in Maryland and manufacture products and sell it to a distributor in Virginia who turns around and sells it to a wholesaler in Kentucky who then sells it to a retailer in Ohio where the injured consumer buys the product, uses it, is injured in Ohio. Is the Maryland defendant subject to personal jurisdiction in Ohio? How many people think yes? How many people think no? The answer's got to be no. Pre-Nicastro, we could have had a debate about it. Post-Nicastro, we clearly don't have a debate about it. That's got to be some purposeful availment beyond just putting your product into the stream of commerce. The Canadian conception is actually broader, as long as it's reasonably foreseeable. Okay, so back to our judgment. Yeah, it should be enforceable in the Canadian courts against the Canadian assets because there's jurisdiction here in the rendering court based on the Canadian conception. Everybody with me? Let's do one EU one and then call it a semester. So take a look at number two. We've got one, two, three different spins on it. let's start with the first one. A German court enters judgment in favor of a German manufacturer in this contract dispute. The German manufacturer then wants to collect on that judgment in the UK against the assets of the US company. Is that judgment going to be enforceable? What do you think? Yes? Anyone? No? So again, let's start with a framework for approaching the problem. Now we're talking about a judgment rendered by a German court. Everybody, your little spidey senses should go up. You've got to at least consider the EU treaty, right? You've got a judgment by a German court. You're trying to recognize and enforce it in the UK. You're over here. Judgment rendered by a court of a member state is presumed to be enforceable. Now, you've got to exercise jurisdiction consistent with the treaty in order for that presumption to be in place. So now we have to figure out whether or not the German court had jurisdiction over the U.S. manufacturer consistent with the treaty. The U.S. manufacturer is not a EU defendant. So even under the treaty, we look to German law to figure out whether or not jurisdiction was proper. Assuming it was, then the treaty says the UK court has to enforce it with some limited exceptions so that this is enforceable against the assets of the US company in the UK. Notice, even if I tell you that the German court exercised jurisdiction, quasi in rem jurisdiction, because the American manufacturer had assets, had money in a bank, a German bank, that's still good enough. That still means under the treaty the UK courts have to enforce that. What if the tables are turned? What if the German court actually finds in favor of the US company? The German company doesn't like that outcome, goes to the UK and institutes a new lawsuit. And the U.S. company says, whoa, 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 hold on. You got to recognize this judgment. We already litigated this suit. Does the U.K. court have to recognize the German court's judgment in favor of the U.S. manufacturer? How many people think yes? Anybody think no? Most people still working on it? So again, you have a judgment by a member state court. Granted, it was in favor of the U.S. defendant as opposed to the German plaintiff, but still a judgment rendered by a member state court. That's presumed to be enforceable as long as the exercise of jurisdiction was consistent with the treaty. Looks like it was. So the U.K. courts have to recognize and enforce this judgment. In contrast, if it's the other way around, if the German manufacturer comes over to the United States and sues, and then tries to sue in the UK, the question is about recognizing and enforcing the US judgment. Now this treaty doesn't apply. Now we just look to UK national law to decide whether or not the court should enforce the judgment. Everybody see? Okay. By the way, one last wrinkle I can't resist. Can't help myself. Let's say that the U.S. company gets a judgment against the German manufacturer here in the United States. Goes over and seeks to enforce that judgment in Ireland against the German manufacturer because the German manufacturer has assets there. Okay, that even though Ireland is a member state, the U.S. is not. And so the recognition and enforcement of that judgment will be pursuant to Irish national law. And let's say that Irish national law would recognize that judgment. Now the U.S. plaintiff goes, aha, I've got a judgment from the Irish court. I'm going to go to Germany, where the real assets are. Is that judgment recognizing? Is that enforceable in Germany? Or under what circumstances would it be?
Would this be the inconsistency of the...
It's not inconsistent. The plaintiff gets a verdict in a U.S. court, goes to Ireland to enforce the judgment, gets an Irish court to recognize and enforce the judgment, and then goes to Germany. There's nothing inconsistent with that. assuming that it hasn't been completely satisfied by Irish Assets.
Well, if Ireland recognized and enforced the judgment based upon their own national law, and if that recognition and enforcement, would it be against the national law of Germany? Would Germany not have to recognize the enforcement action in Ireland?
So that would be the logical conclusion, right? But it turns out that if the Irish court, pursuant to its national law, in order to recognize and enforce that, has to convert it to an Irish judgment, then all of a sudden that Irish judgment actually becomes enforceable in Germany, even though, you're right, the German court may not have actually recognized and enforced the U.S. judgment. Nice little trick to know, and again, on the transaction planning side, right, that it might be helpful to know the national law of the various jurisdictions before you set out on the path of enforcement. Any other questions? Okay, so I really am going to end it. I'm close to ending it when I said I would. Close.